Well, here we are.
It is time, Simba.
If you understand that reference, you might be about the age where we should be working together. It's possible. But it is now one of 3 times a year that I'm accepting clients for my freedom framework, overcoming food sensitivities and increasing energy without unnecessary restriction. My goal for my one-on-one clients is to take them through frameworks and explore tools for achieving 50, 80, 90% of their goals in just a few months and show them how to continue to heal on their own so they don't need me anymore. Honestly, I think we're doing great one-on-one work here, helping women that would otherwise be falling through the cracks, thinking that they're just aging, that they're just moms, that they just, and it may be true that they just have stress, when really those stress hormones and their other core systems just really need some serious support and some serious love to serve them for years to come without symptoms. So if you'd like to clear inflammation, eczema, food sensitivities, or improve energy and brain clarity, I'd love to chat with you. You can book a call with me at kristabigler.com/FSS, kristabigler.com/FSS, and that link will be in the show notes.
One of the things with exercise is you stimulate, you don't annihilate. Way too many people and way too many programs are designed around annihilation. And that is not how you see long-term changes in physiology.
Stress is the inflammation that robs us of life, energy, and happiness. Our typical solutions for gut health and hormone balance have let a lot of us down. We're over-medicated and underserved. At The Less Stressed Life, we're a community of health-savvy women exploring solutions outside of our traditional Western medicine toolbox and training to raise the bar and change our stories. Each week, our hope is that you leave our sessions inspired to learn, grow, and share these stories to raise the bar in your life and home. All right, today on The Less Stressed Life, I have Dr. Eric Corum, and his bio goes like this. Whether fueling the feats of the NCAA athletes or the U.S. Department of Defense, or implementing one of the NFL's first sports science programs, or coaching Olympic gold medalists, Dr. Eric Corum has always been driven by a relentless pursuit of high performance. As time progressed, that drive became a new purpose to translate the science enabling elite performers into actionable recommendations for anyone with the desire to improve. So big topics, all these things bring up different feelings in our own brains. And today we're going to talk a little bit about glymphatics. Welcome, Eric.
Thank you so much for having me. It is a pleasure to be on the show to talk about some nerdy stuff that is going to, I think, really intrigue some folks.
Yeah. So Eric currently lives in Texas, which is one of my other favorite states, I think. I was just telling him it always feels like home when I fly to Texas from here. And so give us a little bit of how did you even get into this topic? Because you said you played, I think, pro football for quite a while. And here we are talking about the detoxification system of the brain. So why don't you give us a little bit of the background on how you decided to get into this?
Yeah. So I wish I would have played pro football. I played at Texas A&M, but I worked in the NFL and with college athletes for quite a long period of time. And in 2011, I pioneered the use of athlete wearable tracking technology. So if you've ever seen a sporting event or a football game where they're like, so-and-so is running on the field at 20 miles an hour, and they'll have like AWS Next Gen Stats. I brought that technology to the US 2011, and it really changed our understanding of what was happening with athletes from an objective standpoint. I then went a step further and was like, okay, it's really nice to know how fast they run, how much distance they cover, these things. But I really want to understand how their bodies are adapting to stress. Because I worked also with Olympic gold medalists in the sprint events, a lot of Jamaicans, amazing experiences there. And no matter whether they were a sprinter or a football player, it didn't matter. They all had the same capability of being able to adapt to tremendous amounts of physical and psychological stress and bounce back really quick. And then we started being able to measure this. We measured it directly from the brain using something called a slow cortical potential or a DC potential. And then we were pairing that with HRV. Now, this is like 12, 13 years ago. And so it was at the early days of all of this stuff. And we were actually able to identify specific ranges that people were in an optimal state of adaptability. The next question then in my mind was, how do I bring this capability to anybody? How do we help them become more adaptable to stress? So I had the crazy idea, while I'm working a full-time job, I'm also going to get a PhD. So I was like, if I'm going to beat myself doing this, like, I want to go study something that's of value and something that, like, you can't survive without: food, water, sleep. So I wonder how sleep impacts our ability to adapt to stress. So I went down that rabbit hole and we looked at these brain biopotentials, and we could literally measure a millivolt potential of the brain. And we could find these optimal ranges where athletes could adapt to mental and physical stress. And it was exactly the same sleep duration ranges that are recommended for the general population. And so this was 2015. And so I just started to want to understand not only like how much sleep do we need, but what are the other behaviors associated with sleep that are going to help? Does timing can matter? Does consistency matter? And then probably most importantly, great, thanks for telling me I need to sleep more. How do I do that? And so that I went on a journey for several years to really kind of unpack that.
No, oh, yeah, there's going to be a lot of hair to unpack. So first of all, someday I'm buying for Guy Raz's job, like how it works. As soon as you were like, I brought this technology to this sector in 2011, I'm like, oh, how did you do that? What made you decide I'm going to figure out how to make wearable tracking technology? Or did you like contract with people? I'm just really genuinely curious on how did
this
you do that?
This is a great question. So I was at Florida State. If anybody follows college football, there was a gentleman named Bobby Bowden. He was the head football coach previously. He was a living legend. They literally had a statue of this guy in front of the stadium, stained glass window. He'd won 2 national titles, 8 conference championship. He was amazing. He retires, new head coach comes in. I'm with that coach. I'm quickly promoted to essentially the general manager role. So I'm in charge of running a $300 million football organization. I've never done this before. I just turned 30. I told the coach, look, I will do this. I have a science background. I'm like, but name me director of sports science. They can call yourself whatever you want. The job didn't exist at the time. So this was just a stroke of luck. The high performance director for a new startup Australian rules football team comes to Florida State with the general manager. Now, AFL in Australia is huge. 100,000 seat stadiums. It is enormous. $1 billion TV contracts. They're like, look, we're about to get the equivalent of like 10 or 15 first round draft picks, but these guys are not going to be any good for 6 or 7 years. And we don't want to lose in a free agency. Would you come here, help us create a collegiate environment? In return, we'll teach you everything we know about sports science. So I literally lived there for a month and I learned about how they structured their high performance department, sports science. And then I saw that they were tracking these players in games and in practices and how they were using this. And I was like, wait a second, nobody's ever really quantified what's going on the field. I brought back 12 tracking units. This company did not exist. None of this existed. And I'm literally duct taping these to the pads of our players. They're connected to satellites. And I had to hire a former NASA propulsion engineer to help me organize the data. Long story short, we were able to use that to drive actionable recommendations that reduced injuries. We had an 88% reduction in injury the next year. We went from 9 to 12 wins, won a championship. The NFL flies in after that season. Like, what is happening? And it literally opened a multi-billion dollar market for wearables, like sports wearables in the US. And so that led, we can talk about later, but led to a career shift for me and what I'm doing now in the general population. But I wanted an advantage. Like, how do you know what to change if you don't really understand what needs to be changed? If it hasn't been quantified, it's your word versus mine, where if we at least have some understanding of objectively what's happening on the field, then we can say, okay, are the way that we're training these players specific to the demands? Are the way that we're practicing them? It's like saying, I need to go run a marathon, but I don't know how far a marathon is. Is a marathon 100 meters or is a marathon 26.2 miles? I don't know. You're just throwing darts and hoping it hits the dartboard.
When you talked about wrapping this on their pads, I got this image because one time I was helping kids do research on pigs and they wanted to measure what they were doing. So they were wrapping them in a diaper and wrapping them around the pigs, taping them on. And this is probably a bad visual, a bad parallel, but it made me laugh a lot inside. So I want to hear about some of the biometrics that were being tracked. What kind of data were you getting from those players real time that you were shifting?
Yeah. So we could get speed. So with GPS satellites, you can measure velocity. You could measure distance. We had accelerometers in there, so we could measure acceleration, decelerations, that gyroscopes and magnetometers, so we could measure positioning and which direction they were facing. Literally anything you could ever imagine. So you don't have to be a football fan to understand this, but like you got Tom Brady, who's a quarterback, right? And all he does is drop back a few feet and throw a ball. versus a receiver that's running thousands of yards in a game, sprinting 750 to 1,000 high-speed yards, and Tom Brady and this receiver are training exactly the same. It makes no sense. It'd be like, I have a business, and the marketing person's going to do exactly what my person in HR does. They're going to need the same education. You're like, no, they're two different things. Nobody ever innovated on that. And then once we were able to understand what was happening in the game from what's called a biodynamic perspective, movement, and we measure their heart rates, so we could understand the energy systems being used. And that was a mind blower, which was American football is a aerobic alactic power game. And most of the training was anaerobic alactic, meaning they were doing a lot of like gassers and things like that. That's not the energy system that's used predominantly. So we also realized like there was, let's say you cover X amount of yards in a game on Saturday. We were covering up to like 5 to 6 times that amount during the week. So our players were just exhausted when they got to Saturday. So once we were able to quantify things, then we could say, let's create an intelligent plan to prepare and peak our athletes for game day. So the parallel to what I'm doing now with my company AIM7 is, it's like, think about this. People have got all these Apple Watches and Oura Rings, and that's descriptive data. It is not prescriptive. So what if I sleep 7 hours? Like, we know that that's in the ballpark, but like, or walk 6,000 steps. Like, what does that mean for me? And how do I use this data to improve my health? When we first started tracking, it caused a lot of friction because the head coach comes to me. He's like, Eric, what are we going to do with this? I'm like, I don't know. And that did not sit very well. And so it wasn't until we could actually turn it into recommendations to make change that it was useful, because data without insight is completely useless.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the magic right there. Yeah, what are you going to do with that? I'd love to hear about the most surprising information that you got from that time period.
You are a wonderful interviewer, by the way. I'm really having to dig back in my brain here.
Well, what happened is, I'm sure you see some parallels in public too.
Yeah, I'll tell you what was very interesting is that, going back to the heart rate data, our best athletes, their average heart rate. Now, this is a game that's like power, speed, explosion, but it's repeated over and over and over again. Their resting heart rate, average heart rate during the game, was never really higher than 130, 135. I'm watching this real time. It would spike to like 175 and then drop down really quick. Why? It's a quick burst, or they were excited. I'm watching literally in a game and a kickoff on national television, and the guy that's about to receive the ball is just standing there and his heart rate's at like 170. He receives the ball, runs down the field, and then he gets to the sideline and goes down. So our players that were more aerobically fit tended to perform better, because energetically, they were more efficient. The aerobic energy system can churn out a lot more ATP. Now, you also have to develop more power speeds. You have these three systems. So it's aerobic, anaerobic, and anaerobic alactic creatine phosphate system. And they're all working together in concert. It's not sequential activation like I was taught 20 years ago. But if you're going to concentrate your time, most of it was spent in this middle zone. We started polarizing training, more low intensity work, more super high intensity explosive work with lots of rest. And guess what? They became way more fuel efficient. That was pretty surprising.
I like that. That's interesting to hear about. My brain can't help but think about where this applies to other people, because I think sometimes when you're looking at men, we've been primarily talking about a data set of men for the most part right now, yeah, right? It could be a little bit different with women, which we don't have to get into yet. One more thing about athletes from my perspective and how I sit seeing them. And the example I use with kind of these, the last few years, people would say, I don't know why these athletes drop dead from this thing that's going on. Mm. And I was like, well, I have seen the athletes have a ton of inflammation, very intentional inflammation, right? Because I would see their nutrient deficiencies looked like worse than most other people's nutrient deficiencies, because they have a lot of intentional inflammation breaking down and building back up. I don't know if you would have been able to see that in the type of metric or the type of bio data you were collecting. Any comments on that?
I think, well, you would have seen inefficiencies in their outputs. Mm. You would have been able to probably see them not being able to sustain high levels of output. If, now that's objective. So there's two types in sports science. This is getting interesting. There's internal and external training loads. The external training load is what you did. Internal training load is how you responded to it.
Ah, nice.
And then there's also objective and subjective. So the problem with these devices is they're typically lagging indicators. Your perception of how you feel is a leading indicator. And so, like, if people wear an Oura ring or something like this, and they're like, oh, my Oura says I'm 85% today, but I feel like I'm 20. I feel terrible. Why? It's a lagging indicator. Mm-hmm. And so we used to run these crazy things. We'd like, oh, I want to know if somebody's stressed. Let's take cortisol. I want to see if they're sore. Let's take creatine kinase. Then we realized if we just asked them, did the right math, and we were able to measure sensitivity of change, it was directly correlated to the biomarkers that we were looking at. So we combine what you did, how you respond to it, subjectively and objectively, HRV, resting heart rate, DC potential of the brain. If you want to take biomarkers, you can, but things that you can measure really quick and get a really good signal off of. I worked predominantly with female sprinters, which is pretty cool. Some of the best of all time, Veronica Campbell-Brown, 8-time Olympic medalist, 3-time Olympic gold medalist, and I've got years of data on her. And without divulging any personal information, like travel would impact her.
Of course.
She'd be happy to talk about this. I mean, she'd be in Europe, going to Middle East, going to wherever, and we're measuring all this stuff. And we're like, okay, like you've just landed. We need a certain amount of days to reboot the system, to get you oriented to that time zone. There were things that we would have to do to try to get her body ready to run. And we could measure like how her autonomic nervous system and her brain was adjusting to travel. And then we would use different techniques to stimulate the nervous system so she could perform. And it was really cool to be able to track this stuff, and me being all the way around the world and being able to look at how her body had just adapted to a 13-hour flight. Now she's 8 time zones off. What do we do?
I would expect that to translate to everyone, right? And actually, did you ever become familiar with, in the 80s, there were some researchers that came across, it's called like the jet lag protocol. There's a book about this. It's a very ancient book. But essentially, we have a handout about this in practice. But I think the premise is that you start following the circadian rhythm of the place you're going 24, 36, 48 hours in advance as much as possible. And then you do not deal with the jet lag stuff. Did you guys ever do anything like that?
Yeah. Her, it was a little more difficult because sometimes she was moving, like she would go to Europe and stay in Europe. So she would go there, get there a week early, and then she would be adjusted. But then she would go to Africa. But yes, and it's also different going east and west. But you're 100% right. And if you're traveling different time zones, sometimes it's best to do nothing. Like for instance, in the NFL, if we traveled on a Saturday and we would go from, let's say it's 2 to 3 time zone shift, you just want to get there and play as quickly as possible. Now, if you're going to Europe, like if you're going from a lot of like Jacksonville seems to do this a lot, then you're going to want to, they actually, a bunch of teams have looked at like, do we go a week early or do we just go the day before? And it's almost better if you just go the day before or something like that. But you're exactly right. Like depending on like if once you land, you want to eat on their schedule, you want to get sunlight on that schedule, and you want to try to exercise as quickly as you can to reacclimatize yourself. If you don't do that, you're going to be completely miserable.
You just said there were things that you did, techniques to stimulate the nervous system to help her perform. Will you talk a little bit about that? Because that's a fun topic.
Yeah. So one of the things with exercise is you stimulate, you don't annihilate. Way too many people and way too many programs are designed around annihilation. And that is not how you see long-term changes in physiology. It's becoming more popular now, but we called it the minimal effective dose. But let's say this was interesting to me. First time I went to a world championship for track, the day before the track meet, she went on the track and she sprinted, like warmed up and did a few short accelerations. In football, it was like a historical way to do it was if you play on Saturday, your last practice was Thursday. You like did nothing on Friday, complete rest, and then Saturday. Well, then we found out like, well, sometimes if your last practice was at Thursday in the evening and Saturday was the next time you did it like in the evening, guys would just be flat. Why? The body has gone 3 days in a row of work, 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 work. What does it do? It completely shifts the autonomic nervous system. And this is where wearables get it wrong. The Whoops and the Auras, specifically Whoop, will over-index on an increase in parasympathetic tone. So your HRV spikes and they're like, yes, that's amazing. No, that is not. Which you actually, that's also the body saying, I have slammed the brake on. It's going to be much harder now to stimulate the body and get going. So what you'd rather do is keep a thread of work in, microdose it. So that's what I learned from track. I'm like, oh, this makes so much sense. What we would actually would do is 2 days before the meet was a rest. The day before the meet was a shakeout and short accelerations to stimulate the nervous system, and you come in fresh. So we actually switched it in college football. We started practicing on Thursday was off. We practiced Friday. The players felt so much better on Saturday. They didn't feel sluggish. Well, people are listening. It's like, what in the world does this have to do with me? Keeping a consistent tone, that we would look at like the tone of the autonomic nervous system or the parasympathetic tone. You want to keep some type of work in the system at all times. So even on a rest day, maybe it's a long walk, 15 minutes of mobility, stretching, moving the body, you're going to feel a lot better. If you go from work, 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 work to completely shutting it down, you're going to feel like a lot of people do this on the weekends. On Monday, they just feel like garbage. Where if you consistently keep some movement in the system, the central nervous system and the autonomic nervous system like that, the body likes to be moving. Doesn't like to completely shut down. It's called active recovery.
I just slowly titling this, don't feel like crap on Monday. Don't mind me over here. We'll get into glymphatics here in a second. Yeah. But some people say that if you already know your sleep's a mess and some of this stuff is a mess, then tracking data, as you call it, descriptive and not prescriptive, is not helpful. Because it's like, I already know I can't sleep. It's not really helpful. It's more stressful for me to see data that tells me I'm not sleeping. What would you say about that?
I would say it's true if there's not a solution. It's like telling you you're bad at math when you're bad at math.
Yeah.
Well, thanks. Thanks for making me feel worse about myself.
Right. That's exactly what it is.
Yeah. I'm going to go find a calculator, right? So my company AIM7 is solving this problem. We pattern matched what happened in sports, all the friction and trouble that was caused with data. Then I started looking at the consumer market and like, you got all these people with wearables. They really have no idea how to use it. So we provide people with prescriptive recommendations for exercise, sleep, and mental health. Like for instance, we pioneered a technology, almost 8 years ago now, where based off of how your biomarkers are adjusting, we can manipulate the type, the intensity, how hard, and the duration of your exercise. And it leads to, I'm talking, we did this with athletes, 150 to 500% more improvement in things like aerobic capacity, peak vertical power, body composition changes. Because if the body is ready to adapt to stress, hammer it. When the window is closing, let's say every day you've heard of these readiness metrics, right? What that really is like, I'm going to get really meta on you here for a second. There's something called adaptive capacity. It's your ability to adapt to stress. And that can be changed over time. But it's like your gas tank. Okay. The size of your gas tank can grow if you invest in five specific things. But every day you wake up with a specific amount of fuel in the tank. It's called an adaptive reserve. It's like your currency for adaptation. And certain things can fill that tank or drain the tank. I've got three kids. Let's say one of them was up all night last night because they're sick. I'm an entrepreneur. I had to work really hard. And let's say, I don't know, my wife and I had a disagreement. I'm not going to wake up with a lot of gas in my tank, right? Now, if I have a really big adaptive reserve, I'm going to have more fuel than you would or somebody else because I built that capacity. But we need to match our stress with what is available. And then we also need to know how to refill that tank. So the recipe for growth is stress plus rest equals growth. You need stress. That is necessary, but you also have to know the type of stress that you need and then how to. So we can provide very detailed recommendations on like, today, if you're going to hop on the elliptical, only go this long and in this heart rate zone. And then we noticed from your HRV and how you feel that you're really stressed. Here's a specific breathwork tool right now to use to shift your autonomic nervous system. Or a gratitude interval, the specific things for your current state, same with sleep. So yeah, if you don't have a specific recommendation, it's like a description of your current state, which can be very demotivating. And I would take the thing off personally.
Right. Yeah. Until you're able to correct the problem. I have some more questions about wearables and data that we can come up with. But first, let's go talk about some sleep stuff. So we've been kind of dancing around that topic for a moment here. So the glymphatic system. We talk about when we think about drainage detox, first of all, I think drainage detoxification applies to absolutely everybody. Some of the more recognized drainage and detoxification systems might include the liver, the kidneys, colon, basically bowel movements, urine, sweat, respiration, but glymphatics are not discussed very often. So give us a little bit of glymphatics 101, Eric.
Yeah, this is new science, okay? So I'm going to give you what I know from what we've gathered in the past 10 to 15 years, roughly. So the rest of the body has a lymphatic system, one of the detoxification systems. The brain does not. What it does is it has these unique paravascular pathways. So what happens is cerebrospinal fluid goes into the brain, mixes with interstitial fluid in the brain, and then at night, only when you are asleep, does this lymphatic system flush out metabolic waste products that are located in the brain, of which one of them is beta amyloid, which is associated with neurodegeneration, diseases like Alzheimer's disease, dementia, traumatic brain injuries. And so the really interesting thing is we've always wondered, like, why is it that when you get a really good night of sleep, you kind of have this clear thinking, it's like a very restorative feeling, you kind of feel bright and airy. You have a bad night of sleep, it's like you got brain fog. You literally have metabolic crap stuck in your brain. And so I started thinking about this. I'm like, okay, we have this lymphatic clearance that happens during sleep at night. We are seeing a significant rise in cases of Alzheimer's disease, dementia, neurodegenerative diseases. I think 5.8 million Americans have this disease right now, and it's doubling every 5 years in people over 65. It's the sixth leading cause of death in the U.S. By 2060, it's expected that over 14 million people will have this disease. Why is that? Well, look at our sleep. Our sleep durations have been plummeting. 35.2% of U.S. adults sleep less than 7 hours a night. Now, research demonstrates that there is a U-shaped curve relationship between diabetes, cardiovascular disease, and even all-cause mortality, with the 7 to 9 hour window is ideal. Okay. 32.6% of working adults report sleeping less than 6 hours a night. So if our sleep is declining, and we understand that the lymphatic system is responsible for flushing out all this junk at night, and we know that one of those proteins that's getting stuck in there is beta amyloid and some of these other things, and that's a indicator, or that's a causative agent for neurodegenerative diseases. I can't say it's causation yet, but it's pretty strong.
So what are we going to do about it, right?
Yeah.
And so the problem is that we can talk about what's impacting sleep. We've got light issues. We've got all kinds of circadian disruption. But it's a big, I don't know the numbers right now, but when I see stats about people having sleep issues, I'm like, oh my gosh. So I think people would say, the person listening to this is like a generally health savvy person. It's interesting, right? How do you make this sexy enough to actually do the thing, right? So there's two camps of people. There is, I know I should, but I'm not doing it. And then the other camp of, but I'm having trouble sleeping. So we got to talk about these two camps of people.
Yeah. I mean, look, it's if you're in the know you should and you can sleep, but you're not doing it. Let me take two of them off the table. I'm a night person. And number two, I don't need that much sleep. Number one, I can almost guarantee you don't have the snippet for not needing enough sleep. It's like a fraction of 1% of the population. It's the genetic polymorphism. Number two, there was a great study done by MIT and Harvard. It's called the Broad Institute. It's a conglomeration between those two. They're right next door to each other. And the University of Colorado. And they looked at over 800,000 people in the UK biobank. And they used 23andMe data. They had sleep tracking. They used diaries. And they wanted to look at the effect of chronotype on depression. First of all, they found that genetically, only 9% of people are actually evening type. 9%. Those of us that aren't really evening type and they're going to bed later, it's because of things like our phone, social media, TV. We're stimulating ourselves when our body should really be going to sleep. Very interesting. They found that if you shift your sleep onset back by 1 hour, there was a 23% reduction in major depression. Shift it back 2 hours, almost a 40% reduction. Why is that? Well, people that go to bed earlier and wake up earlier, get more what?
Deep sleep, exercise, sunlight. I'm not sure. Sunlight. Okay, got it.
And when you view sunlight, it kicks off a cascade of hormonal and neurological events that directly impact your mood and your risk of depression. So if you know you should be doing it and you're not doing it, like, I can't help. I mean, it's like, if you want to perform at your best, if you want to make great decisions, if you want to set yourself up for success, if you're exercising, you know, what I would do is I would link sleep to something that's a value to you, a value like self-care, a value like excellence, a value like maybe family, whatever it is. And if you can connect, if it's sleep or anything else, to something that's a value to you, that is core to who you are, it makes it easier to take action when emotion enters the equation. When like, oh, I could stay up and watch such and such, or you know what? I really value my family. And I know when I don't get enough sleep, I'm grumpy. Or I really am pushing hard at work right now and I want to get this project across the line. I value excellence, so I'm going to go to bed. So that's like camp one.
Yeah. I want to underline that a little bit just because these are often very brilliant, smart people that do this, right? We all do things sometimes that we know we shouldn't do, but we want to do. And it's this damn subconscious, the other 95% of us, that's a little bit self-sabotaging. So you're gamifying it, which doesn't surprise me at all. If you have an app that makes prescriptive data, of course you gamify everything, right? So it's very natural for you to recommend a gamification, which I think makes sense because we are humans. So we love whatever we can link to immediate gratification. That is all we care about, right? As humans, we're like, okay, oh, yep. I love my grandkids. I know that this causes this. Okay, I'm back on track, you know? So I don't know. I just think whatever you can do to be tangible is helpful. Because for me, some of this is just, this is like your subconscious. It's your emotions. Mm. This is like the life coaching stuff, right? That's kind of tricky, but I liked your answer.
I appreciate it. It's something that we have a lot of really amazing performance psychologists on our team. And we really thought about like, how do we help people take action for their own best self-interest?
It's the age old question.
Yeah. And in long-term goal pursuit, I mean, it's in the literature. A lot of this has to do with psychological flexibility. When you can link actions to values, people will take action, especially if the value is really core to who they are. But thank you. I mean, we're trying to just help folks and like, you got to dig in deep, right?
Yeah. How do you make this attractive enough that I want to do it?
Right.
Always, right? Like, what emotion can you press on that I actually care enough about? Ooh, spoiler alert, you get to pick the emotion. That's the best part.
You are super sharp. I love this conversation is awesome because I love the fact that you are pushing back and touching the right buttons. There's a reason why you're successful. I can only imagine being one of your clients. For the other camp of people that are having difficulty sleeping, there's a lot of layers to unpack, a lot of which you probably have already talked about in the past. Circadian anchoring, sunlight, exercise, the basic stuff, food, not eating late at night, avoiding alcohol in the evenings. You know, really, I was really interesting. I had Sachin Panda. You know Sachin Panda?
Yeah.
So he was on my podcast recently and he started talking about there's some emerging research with melatonin production and exposure to sunlight during the day, meaning like the more exposure you get during the day, the more melatonin production. Because melatonin isn't just excreted from the pineal gland. It's actually like, I believe, in the mitochondria as well. Mm-hmm. And there's receptors in your skin. And so I believe there's something to the fact that our bodies are not designed to be living indoors all the time. And if you want to unhinge somebody, like keep them inside. It's like when you go to a conference.
Yeah.
And you're there like day two and you're like, where am I? Like, what world are we living in? I'm in the Gaylord. I'm like, where is this thing? And I'm like, I deliberately have to go outside and be like, oh, the sun, like life exists. People live their life. They get in, they go from in the house, into the car, to work, back into the house, and that's it. And I've had the opportunity to work with different special operations groups. And one of the things that I learned working with guys that had very traumatic experiences and couldn't sleep, they would go camping 2 to 3 weeks. All of a sudden, they were able to start sleeping 6.5, 7 hours a night. Mm-hmm. Part of that is the green space. Part of it is their body is now anchored to their external environment. They're in a rhythm of waking up when the sun comes up. They exercise, they hike, they move. So that, and then basic hygiene. When the sun goes down, everything in your house should start dimming. If you're following all the basic stuff, your room is cold, dark, and quiet like a cave. I mean, if you're doing all the things and it's still not happening for you, then I think that's the time you need to go see a doctor and go see a legit specialist that has an expertise in this. But I would check off all the boxes. Am I exercising adequately? Am I at least getting 150 minutes of heart rate elevated exercise a week? Am I doing some resistance training? The basics. Have I done anything for my mental health? Is it anxiety? Is it my thoughts that are keeping me up? What am I doing to brain dump before I go to bed so I can go lay in bed and rest? Like journaling helps a lot of people. It helps me. I'll go do my whole schedule for the next day. So when I get into bed, it's like I have nothing to think about. You know,
I agree with everything you're saying there, I just want to share another little story. I had a client who was really frustrated with her HRV on her Aura ring. And there's a lot of things going well, you know, but that just was like not doing its thing. And then it started shifting and decided the main input was some breathwork changes, right? Breathing dysfunction is big for all kinds of, like, we're talking about sleep, which people know is important. Another thing we discount the most, I think, is our breath and how we're breathing functionally, right? And so there's a lot. So just with some like more intentional breathwork practices, that seemed to improve the HRV, which was kind of an interesting one. And I will say, like, the more severe the sleep issue, the more those sleep hygiene practices seem to be important. Because when I see clients, like I see gut microbiota issues being an issue because that's where a lot of serotonin is produced and that's a precursor to melatonin. So I find that it's all useful. But if you're not starting with like circadian exposure, getting your suprachiasmatic nucleus exposed to that sun, right? And then what do you do if you wake up and it's winter and or you're one of those people who are in different shifts, right? Well, then there's full spectrum light therapy, right? Like there are some cool workarounds, right? Even if it's like your life, you can't just go camping for 3 weeks. When you brought that up, it made me think of this book I just loved by Florence, but it's called The Nature Fix. And it just talks about all the nervous system impact from that. It's so cool. I think so often we discount all of those like trauma things in life. And there's just so much that's like rattling people on the inside and impacting their sleep. It's like, there's plenty of people that can make lots of careers out of sleep stuff. I mean, it is the most common issue. It's a very, very common problem.
I had a mentor of mine, Dr. Gershon Tenenbaum, told me once, everything is complex, multidimensional, and relative. And when problem solving, you have to start thinking, what are all the things that could be input? And so you're right. Like, I'm in a very stressful period of my life right now. We're raising a seed round. We're scaling a product. There's a lot of things going on. And the other day, my area I have to focus on is mental health. Our mental fitness, that's what we like to call it. And I hadn't really done a lot that week. And I was like, okay, stop. Do 5 minutes. I felt so much better.
Yeah.
And I was like, you know, usually for me.
100 times.
Yeah.
10,000 times.
Just go sit in the closet for 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And just be alone with your thoughts.
Yeah.
And that alone, like these little things add up.
Yeah, for sure. Well, and that is something that you said in different words earlier is like looking at this parallel between kind of this semi-pro athlete version and what parallels to us is that a little bit every day is actually more important than a whole bunch on one day. That's what I heard you say.
Consistency always beats intensity.
Totally. Yeah. Apply that to circadian rhythm, right? If you are normal circadian rhythm at least 80% of the week, then hopefully it can negate those couple nights you did the night shift, right? That's always the hardest. That's always the hardest one is like the night shift people, right?
I love it. You are so practical. I really appreciate that.
Hey, practical. Practical or die. Okay, so we're talking about lymphatics. You talked about how the brain does not have a lymphatic system and we require sleep. I actually kind of got stuck right there. So we were talking about when we don't have good sleep, we're getting too much beta amyloid buildup. This is a problem that we see in these neurodegenerative diseases that are on the rise. You also mentioned TBIs, right? Traumatic brain injuries. I am so fascinated at what happens when people have concussions, even like things they don't even think about. And I'm sure you've seen a ton of this in the sports industry. And what it does to their gut, to their immune system, to everything else. It's absolutely fascinating what comes out the other side. I am just like mildly obsessed with it. So talk to me a little bit more about like lymphatics. If we're not getting sleep, metabolic crap literally is getting stuck. So we talked about getting good sleep. Is there anything else we should talk about related to the physiology of the lymphatic system that helps make this even more sexy?
I could give you some things that research is showing is improving in lymphatic clearance outside of sleep.
It. Yes, that's what we want to know.
Marine-based fish oil consumption increases lymphatic clearance, reduces inflammation, and research points to the fact that it reduces cognitive decline. How much? 2 to 4 grams a day.
Yeah, that is 4 grams is kind of my preference. And that's going to be usually at least twice as much of what, because often capsules are 500 milligrams. And so people don't think, people are like, oh, I take that. I'm like, well, how much? 500? Like, well, that's not going to do. You're not going to actually see differences typically. Other caveat with this, it's not really a caveat. It's just quality matters so much, right? Because oxidation.
Yes.
So you cannot just go like pick up fish oil at, like, if it's cheap, it's probably sucks.
It's rancid.
Yeah, it probably sucks. If it does smell rancid, it probably is. So that is where, if there's any negative research around fish oil, I think that's pretty much why it's trash, you know, and that's the challenge. That is actually the case with every supplement is like, you must find something quality. And you can test this on your own. There's a company actually in my state that does finger prick tests for omega-3 index. And so it's like $50. You can go check your own omega-3. Anyway, it doesn't hurt to try it though. Carry on. I just like to put the caveats in because sometimes people are like, I've tried that. And I'm like, let's talk about the good way to try it.
Okay, yes. And you probably have some recommendations for your audience on some companies that they could go towards on that one. But intermittent fasting. Now, look, it is not a magic bullet. Dr. Krista Verade is a person that I would highly recommend listening to. I just had her on and that was mind blowing. She's done more research in human models, not rats, but alternate day fasting. You have to be hardcore to do this now. You don't eat anything or less than 500 calories for one day, then you eat normal the next day. Increases AQP4 aquaporin channel polarization. And these channels are responsible for fluid flow. So it actually improves how much fluid is flushing out. Why? I have no idea.
I think it's because the body wants to dump crap it doesn't need under like that stress. That's how I perceive intermittent fasting supporting things. It's like it improves autophagy. And so it probably improves other. If your body's not busy doing other stuff, it's like, well, let me unload the freeloaders. Goodbye.
There you go. Why not? Like, it's not messing with caloric intake. Your sleep position. Gravity affects the movement of blood and cerebrospinal fluid to the brain. And therefore, your sleep position can play a role in this. Intracranial pressure and cerebral blood flow are influenced by body posture. Patients with dementia have been found to spend more time in the supine position or on their backs.
So what are we supposed to do?
Side.
Interesting.
I can't do it, though. So I'm just throwing stuff out there. I did a deep dive on this recently, and these were things that actually popped up in the literature that had some good studies. And the last one, which I really like, is aerobic exercise. We know that it improves BDNF, brain-derived neurotrophic factor, which helps with lymphatic clearance, also helps with neuroplasticity. It boosts memory and cognition. There was a study there, 6 weeks of running reduced brain inflammation, increased lymphatic clearance and amyloid beta clearance. I think it was about 150 minutes a week. So aerobic exercise, it's like it really all kind of goes back to the basics.
Yeah. Go for a walk, in other words, is what he said.
Eat healthy food. Go for a walk.
In the sun and walk a dog. Your life is while all you solved.
Eat your salmon.
Sleep on your side. Sleep on your side. Yes. Let's just habit stack all that stuff up, improve the old lymph. But what I think the bottom line for me is like, hey, if you know you're not sleeping, if you know you could change some things around your sleep, if you can cool down your room, if you can get dark shades. I actually have to do this a lot and I don't always do it because I forget now, but I always think like, hello, let us talk about what does it look like to get eight? What time would you like to get up in the morning? Oh, this is what time you would like to get up in the morning? Great. Let's work backwards. How long is it going to take to get 8 hours of sleep? Okay, great. Now let's take 90 more minutes before that and say that is when you have to start to think about sleep if you want to have good sleep. Because if you spike your cortisol from watching Yellowstone before bed, which I will not do, not doing it, then you are 90 minutes awake and no one needs this stuff. So anyway, so it's like, wow, okay, I did the math on that and I was, no wonder I cannot sleep, right? Mm. Like, start there. And also try not to roll over and look at your phone first thing. Now your brain says it's noon. Go look at the sun.
That is something I've really had to, I mean, well, let's just be honest. Like that's a hard thing. And so like my phone wakes me up. I like to get up early. That's just me. I like to go to bed early, wake up really early, like 5 o'clock. And I like to get up and walk before anybody else is up and to work early. And so I've been disciplining myself to just turn it off. Don't look at the stupid phone. Go get my day started. The messages will be waiting, right? The emails. Give yourself some time to just be. And I think it's super helpful.
Well, it's kind of like you said this earlier. You said, you know, I just was not doing, thanks for the term mental fitness, because everything is about making something sexy, right? And like, okay, adopting mental fitness as a term. So you said you were really like out of sorts. I mean, that was my beginning of May. My oldest graduated, had all this stuff going on. We were doing a bunch of stuff with work. And I was like, I am not good right now. This is not okay. Because what goes out the door first? All of your neuroplasticity work, all of your brain work, all of your mental fitness work, so to speak. And before you know it, you're waking up, reacting, checking all this stuff. It doesn't work. And I would say at least once a year, I end up in a place without phone service for more than a day, you know? And man, that's the best when you come back. You're like, oh, I broke the dopamine hit. I broke the neural pathway because I didn't have anything to reach for. And of course, we can always like, if we really want to, right, we can try to this, right? We could have an alarm clock that acts like a sunrise. We could do the thing with your phone where you turn the color red before you go to bed, right?
So night shift.
Right? Night shift. There's a lot of options, which is cool. So like what you said earlier from Dr. Tenenbaum, you kind of like a famous mentor. Did you have him?
Yeah, he was a kind of a giant in the field of sports psychology.
Oh, okay.
He was at Florida State, but very lovely man. And he told me that and it just like wrecked my world for a little bit.
I know. We always want things to fit in a one-liner, but it's like, hey, if you think you've done everything, it's okay. Just write it all down. Someone else can point out a couple other opportunities. That's kind of my thing. It's like, there's always an opportunity here for something else. Okay, I know we need to wrap up here. So kind of my question, a little bit about wearables. And I know you want to maybe share a little bit more. You did a good job intermixing it there. But if one of the conversations is wearable data isn't always accurate, you take possibly inaccurate wearable data and turn it into good predictive stuff.
I've done 35 podcasts in the past 3 months. These are the best questions. Like if you're listening to the show, this is phenomenal. This is really good.
I would really like to be a professional podcaster, which is just a made up thing, right? I really like to ask questions of everyone for a living. Carry on.
It's great. You just need a trend line. Like if it's consistently inaccurate. So actually, this is, you're going to love this one. You should put this in the show notes because I think people will find this fascinating. I had a graduate student at the University of Kentucky, a doctoral student. And he spent 3 months. I'm like, here's all the things I want to know about all these wearables. On my website, it's aim7.com/blog. And I'll send it to you. It's like this, the accuracy of wearable technology. And we went device by device for the things that people are most concerned about. Caloric intake, caloric burn, massively off. Steps, sleep. By the way, sleep phases, total baloney. Don't even look at it. Don't waste your time. Just look at duration. Onset and awakening is pretty good. Activity, heart rate, all the stuff. We racked and stacked them all. If it's consistently inaccurate, but it's always off by 7%, it's totally fine. Or even 8%. We're looking at a trend line of change. It's just like these body comp assessments. None of them are 100% accurate. You need a multi, like, it's like a multimodal model. Like you, even like the DEXA can be off by 5-6%. So like, if we know it's off by 5-6% and the next time I go in, it changed 2%, but I know it's off by 5-6%, guess what? It's just a trend line. So what we do is we're looking for the signal and the noise. And we have very specific ways that we do some advanced mathematics in the back end to know, is this a true signal? Is it a big deviation from your standard and norm? So we do a lot of really cool things because we spent like 12 years in sports solving all of these problems. We're like, we can bring this into the consumer space. We make it hard for people to dig in. Like all the graphs and stuff are in the app, but that's not what people really want to know. They just want to know, what do I do with it?
Yeah.
And so you can dig in and we got all the graphs, but most people don't have time to go download their Excel spreadsheets and like run regression analysis on it and all that kind of stuff. They want to know.
So just certain profiles of people that would like that.
Certain profiles. It's like that 10% outlier and they'll love it too. We give them all that stuff. But it's like, if my HRV is off, what do I do? And how does that impact my exercise? How does that impact my mental health or mental fitness? What should I be doing in these areas when I see these signals? We give all that stuff. We built this for busy people that are time poor, that care about their health and wellness. They just want to be told, like, from a trustworthy source, like, what do I do today? I've got a limited amount of time. I want to move the needle on my health and wellness. Is today the day for me to really go crush it in the gym? Or is today the day that I should go for a 20-minute walk, spend 5 minutes breathing, pat myself on the back and be like, you know what? You did a great job. That's what people need to be told.
This is good.
Thank you.
I'm curious about this as a recent new Apple Watch person.
And I saw that.
Guess why I did this? Because I can now forget where I put my phone all the time and my kids can get a hold of me.
You can swipe up and it goes,
it doesn't really do much. It doesn't like do a lot. It has a bunch of stuff there, but I can't really access it. So it's like kind of broken, a little bit of the grab your phone to see if you have any messages issue. So that's interesting. I will not wear it sleeping because I don't want to have a device on me when I'm sleeping. But I broke up with the Oura Ring because they don't really have any customer service. So congratulations, Oura Ring. I'm going to say that. But
kind of like Google. If you ever need them, they're never there.
Yeah, that's actually very true too. I remember one time I got locked out of my professional accounts. It was very exciting. Very exciting. I'm just so curious that there hasn't been like a new Ring wearable. So there are some new ones. I have one coming. So anyway, getting back, and when my Oura Ring stopped working because I got a new phone, cute. I was like, well, I'm good on data tracking. I think it's like really nice to go through some phases of like mm-hmm. where you're at with things. And it's like, oh, I need to get back on the old curiosity train on what kind of biomarkers I have going on. So I'm going to give this a try. I have no idea how it's going to work. I should have checked it out before I interviewed you. It'd be more interesting for everyone.
It's called AIM7. I'll tell you what.
Yeah, please
tell
us about it.
You have a lifetime membership, and I would love your feedback, but it's in private beta, which means you can only get access to it on our website. We have about 3,000 people on our waiting list. When you sign up, if you say, I heard you on the podcast here, we will move you right to the front of that list. We let people in every couple of weeks, and we'll be in the App Store probably this fall. We integrate with all the major wearables. But really, what it is, it's like, what do I do today for my mind, body, and recovery to help me look, feel, and perform better? And then after a week, we analyze your data and we're like, oh, here's the specific area you should focus on. Then we create a realistic goal. We wrap that up in this really neat behavior design model. So the first week, you're actually going to learn how to create lasting habits that are tied to your values, like we talked about earlier. And then we create a goal for you. And then we have a masterclass library from some of the best in the world in there. I went and got the former senior sports psychologist for the US Olympics, the head of director of wellness and development for the Toronto Raptors. We've just brought on some amazing folks with very short educational videos and audio messages that are less than 2 minutes. So this is built for busy parents, busy people. They're like, hey, well, I'm having my coffee in the morning. I want to learn about this while I'm moving towards my goal. We're about to release a bunch of new features here in the next couple of weeks that I'm super psyched about. Like, my HRV is off. What exactly do I do in these specific areas? That we already have that wrapped into our recommendation layer, but we're going to give you like very granular details for people that are just, that want to scratch that itch.
I know my exact clients that want this. So that's cool. But for everyone else listening who also loves their health, because those are the people that are listening, maybe there'll be a special link in the show notes, or can they just go to AIM7?
Go to AIM7.com. We can link something up for you. We'll connect afterwards. Free 7-day trial, and it's just $15 a month. We're not trying to gouge people. We want to provide a ridiculous amount of value for a laughable price. I'm serious. Like, we're on a much bigger mission here than to go out and make, yes, we want to have a living, but I don't think there is tremendous power in this data if it's actually used. Otherwise, take the darn thing off and throw it away. It will end up in your sock drawer because it's going to cause more problems than good. But if you can use it to actually improve your life, it's not shaming you and it's actually helping you feel better, be a better person, then I think it's a value.
Yeah, no one likes a shaming device.
No.
All right. Eric, Dr. Corum, thank you so much for coming on today. Find you at ericcorum.com, aim7.com. All of that will be in the show notes.
Yes. Thank you so much. It was a pleasure to be on. For the best questions I have had all year long, this is phenomenal.
Greatest compliment. Love it. Thank you so much.
Sharing and reviewing this podcast is the best way to help us succeed with our mission to help integrate the best of East and West and empower you to raise the bar on your health story. Just go to reviewthispodcast.com/less-stressed-life. That's reviewthispodcast.com/less-stressed-life. And you'll be taken directly to a page where you can insert your review and hit post.